Accession number 16790, Real One.
Mr. Stark, Real One, where were you born, please?
I was born in Bournemouth.
Which year was this?
I beg your pardon?
Which year was this?
Oh, 1932.
What did your father do for a living?
Oh, my father was an invalid. He suffered from neurasthenia, which was... he was afraid to go out. And I used to watch the doctor take him down the road in his car and tell him he was on his own to walk back. And he would run all the way till he got indoors again.
Did you go to school in Bournemouth?
I went to school in Bournemouth, yes.
Do you remember anything about the Second World War very much?
I can recall being in bed one night and the bedroom door slamming when some bombs went off down at Kinsin, which was about 2 miles from where we lived, maybe a little less. And I can remember jumping out of bed and down the stairs, probably doing it in two.
What was your address during the war?
My address was Wheatley Road, which was off Kinsin Road and near where the bombs dropped.
Did Bournemouth get much bombing in the war?
There was not a great deal, but I can remember another episode when we were down at a place called Ensbury Park off Columbia Road one Sunday morning, and a landmine dropped on the school in Alma Road, I think it was, and troops had moved out of the school the night before. I can remember that very loud explosion taking place. I can also remember walking up the road, walking up Kinsin Road, going to my grandmother's house, and the siren going. I was walking up the road, and I can remember seeing two aircraft up in the sky and watching the dogfight, and hearing the machine guns, and seeing one plane with smoke coming out of it, coming down towards Earth, and the pilot falling out of the plane, but his parachute not opening, and it was the Spitfire that had caught it up.
Now, how did you come to be in the Royal Marines?
Well, I left school when I was 14, and I spent 3 years as a butcher's boy, learning the butcher's trade and delivering meat. And at that time, meat was rationed. So I, when I was about just coming up to 17, I asked my boss for another rise. And he said, sorry, John, as long as meat's on the ration, I can't give you another one. So that decided me on joining the Royal Marines, actually. My grandfather was also in the Royal Marines. And he joined up in 1889. His first ship was the Plover, which was a sailing ship. He used to chew tobacco because they weren't allowed to smoke on board, as it was a wooden ship. He'd put it up under his hat to dry and then smoke it when he got ashore.
So you joined the Marines in 49?
In April 1949, yeah.
Was it easy to get in?
It was difficult to get out once you got in. No, it wasn't easy to get in, actually. In fact, I thought I'd failed on the colourblind test. But they put you through a series of tests, and I was okay.
Can you say something about your training?
My training? In those days, you did about 16 weeks at Dill, which was... basically learning you to swim, building you up, discipline, drilling all the time. From there we moved on to Portsmouth, where we spent a fortnight on a cruiser doing learning how to tie knots and everything. We then went to the gunnery school at Fort Cumberland, where we spent 6 weeks doing naval gunnery. We then went on to Limpston, which was then known as the Infantry Training Centre, down in Devon, where we did all our infantry training.
Did you already know by this stage that you were to be a commander?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. After completing training at Limpston, we then went to the commando school at Bickley, where we did our commando course, and I finished the 30-miler across Dartmoor and got presented with my green beret on my 18th birthday, which was 11 months after I, 11 months all but 1 week after I joined the Marines, first joined up. After completing that, I then specialised in heavy weapons, which was machine guns and mortars. At that time it was the Vickers machine gun, 303, and 3-inch mortars.
How did you come to be in 41, Commander?
I was on a reinforcement draft. I think we sailed in July from Liverpool on HMS Devonshire. And after we left Colombo, Major DeLeith, who was in charge of the draft, then fell us all in and told us about the war in Korea and that part of us, part of the draft, would be going to Korea.
How did you feel about that?
Quite happy, actually. Quite happy.
Why?
Well, I was on my way to 4-2 Commando at Ipoh Perak in Malaya, which was fighting terrorists in the jungle. This came out of the blue, and it was something different, something we were going to look forward to. You know.
Why should you prefer Korea to Malaya?
We didn't know at that time, but we knew we were going to come under the Americans, and I think this was what we were looking forward to, better food and everything. And by the time we got to Singapore, we discarded our weapons, our equipment that we normally wear and everything, because we were going to fly up to Japan, you know, ready for to make up the numbers of 4-1 Commando. So we had some more injections, vaccinations, etc., out at Changi Airport, and we flew off at 4 o'clock in the morning in the old Decoters, bucket seats, about 17 to each Decoter. And we stopped on the way at Labuan in Borneo, and then at Clarkfield in the Philippines, and then on to Japan.
How many were in this reinforcement draft?
Oh, it was just 34 in our two planes, you know, in the two Decoters we went. Many more followed, because I should imagine about 50% of the unit came out by HMS Devonshire, and about 50% flew out from UK.
And then you arrived in Japan?
We arrived in Japan. We all went to Camp McGill, this big barracks, and I believe then that Colonel Drysdale gave us all a talking to and told us what was expected of us, and that he had so many weeks to train us, and we were due to go into action then. We all thought, well, you must be joking at that time. But
you mean you thought it would be too soon?
Well, we had to, not in that respect, it's just a Marine's expression, really. We had to learn all American weapons. We discarded the British weapons and left them behind. And we used to start training about 6 o'clock in the morning, you know. And if you were sat on your bed at midnight cleaning your weapon in that, you'd finished early. Very often at night you'd be out in the rubber boats, out in the bay. Camp was Camp McGill was right near the sea. So we'd either be out practicing in the boats at night, or during the day, or learning weapons, and that was it. But there were so many weapons to learn, you know. What was there? It was the BAR, the Browning Automatic Rifle, which would replace the Bren. There was carbines and Garands, which would replace our 303. 4.5 pistol. There's a few Thompson submachine guns. Instead of the little 2-inch mortar, there was the 61mm mortar. There was a bazooka, which was followed by the rocket launcher in later years. That had to be learned. Me being heavy weapons, we also had to learn the 81mm mortar and the 30 caliber machine gun, which would replace the Vickers, and the 50 caliber machine gun. So it was quite something.
Did you prefer the American weapons?
Not when we got into the ambush in there. I would have been much happier with my bolt action 303.
Well, we'll come on to that later when we come on to the action itself. Mm. Any other preparations that you made?
Rubber boats in that. We had to learn how to capsize and how to steer and everything, you know. Everything about rubber boats and raids, commando raids. We'd done landings during our training and things, rocky landings and that, from Dory's down at Plymouth, at Jenningscliff and that in Plymouth. But this was American rubber boats, much like the inflatable dinghies today, where you would sit straddled, four men each side, and you'd have a bowman and a coxswain, where you had capsizing drill to do and righting the dinghy again. We weren't all that brilliant swimmers, you know, but you'd sit out in the bay and ride out in the bay and have to get it all together, you know, and this was it. Then you'd have to do it at night and things like this. But we made it. And it was then in the September that B Troop went off on the USS Perch on the submarine, and they carried out a raid. I think they were going to do two raids, but the weather got rough, and we did their second one. We went off. I came back from the PX one day. We'd just been over for coffee, and some of the chaps were packing up and making their way to get onto boats to go out to these two destroyers that were anchored out in the bay. You know, we said, "Where are you going?" They said, "We're going on those destroyers." So we had to nip back and get our kit. And the two destroyers were the USS Bass and the Montauk. And we were going to do two raids off of them.
Which we did.
I was heavy weapons, but I was attached to, I was on the Bass, the USS Bass, and I was attached to the assault engineers. So during the raids, I was wiring up the primer cord. I worked with a chap called Tommy Dunbrit. I've never seen him since, or since we came home in March 51. But he'd stand guard while I was pushing the plastic explosive into the sides of the railway lines and wiring up for the two raids. I did that.
What was the objective on the two raids?
Well, we had a tunnel and a length of railway line which we wanted to blow to cut the North Korean supply. This was right up near the Manchurian border, you know, quite way up. The first raid, the first night, I can remember sitting in the boat and quite interesting actually. I was in the same boat as Major Aldridge, who was the second in command of the unit. Each man carried two 20-pound packs of explosive. So you had 400 pound of explosive to each boat, 10 men. We also had Tom Dryberg, who was the war correspondent in our boat. And I can remember being in the boat. The P-boats used to take us in so far, tow us in the rubber boats, and then we'd release and we'd paddle in the rest of the way. And on the first night, it was quite interesting, actually. So I remember we were packing in the explosive. Somebody said, there's a train coming. And somebody said, I've left some explosive on the line. And somebody else said, well, get it off then. But no train came anyway, and we packed it in and finished and everything. Got back down to our boats, rubber boats. And we paddled out so far and hooked up ready, but we had to wait for it to blow. And I remember Major Aldridge saying, well, if it doesn't, we'll have to go back in. And it went. And it was like the heavens opening up, you know, because there must have been about 2,000 pounds of explosives going up, something like that, you know, like the heavens opening up. And the P-boats immediately opened up their engines and took us away, you know, back to the ship. You know, and it was certainly used to get the old adrenaline going, you know, I think. It's what the commando was meant for, doing the raids, and it was great.
What was a P-boat?
Powerboat, like a landing craft type boat, you know, and it would hook up to about four dinghies, four of the inflatables, tow us in so far, wait for us while we paddled in, then hook up again, you know, and then back out again. That was on the first raid, and you get back on board ship, and you'd have a tot of rum and everything, you know, I'm sure, and it was great, you know, and it was great success. The second night we went in, and Peter Thomas swam ashore first. Back in the P-boats again, they towed us in so far, and Peter Thomas, who was, at that time, he was my troop commander, he was lieutenant then, he swam ashore and signaled us with a little pen torch, a little green light, you know, that was all clear to come in. They didn't allow Tom Dryberg to go in on the second raid because they thought there was going to be opposition. But I was once again in the same boat as the 2IC, Major Aldridge, and we had Sam, I think his name was, the interpreter, an interpreter this time. And the things I remember most was Sam didn't want to get out the boat when we got there, and Major Aldridge getting him all by the scruff of the neck in the seat of his pants and just throwing him up the beach. And this time we had a bridge and a tunnel. Now, I don't know if you know, with Primacord, everything's tied up together, so everything goes up at the same time with plastic, with the explosive and that. And part of the boys was packing it in the tunnel and along the railway line, and they were packing it around these stanchions at the bottom where the bridge went over the viaduct. Apparently it had been bombed before, but the Americans couldn't blow it up. And I walked out with the primer cord to drop it down through on the stanchion. I remember doing that, and I used to think I could see daylight through the sleepers and that, you know. And if a train comes, where do I go? Because there's no sides on the bridges. It was just sleepers sort of thing, you know. And anyway, did it. Back to the beach. I think it was on the second raid when Corporal Babs, I think he threw his gun, or somebody threw their gun in the rubber boat. It went off and he got killed. And he was a chap who was who you call SBS today. He was a swimmer canoeist, and he'd gone right through the war and got away with it. And unfortunately, a bullet went through him and killed him. So that was one casualty we had, and I know that I think there was a Marine Jones in B Troop on the USS Perch who got killed as well. So we had the burial at sea in that.
But you didn't meet enemy opposition ashore?
I remember when I was up the top packing in, and this old man who looked like a Ho Chi Minh with a long white beard coming down the track, you know, and my chum, Tommy Dunbrick, who was guarding me, like, didn't see what it was, I could see somebody going. He said, "What shall I do?" I said, "Don't shoot him." But he shooed this old boy and he went on down the track, you know, toddled off down. But machine guns did open up. We were back out at sea. They did clear a lot of people down onto the beach at one end. Some of the people, you know, when the they rounded up while we were doing the operation there. And we left them sheltered there. And we got back out in our rubber boats and we were hooked up again. I remember when it went up, there was pieces of sleeper coming down in the pieces of railway track and that coming down in the water around us. And there was some firing from ashore, quite a bit. Probably a machine gun or something. But it didn't touch us, you know. And I don't know if it caught the people that we'd put in on the beach. But they were very successful, the three raids. And I think when it was seen what a good job we'd done in that, the British ambassador, Sir Alfred Gascoigne, he came up and inspected the unit and invited us all to the British Embassy in Tokyo. You know, and we went up there in our blues and that. We were announced as we went in. Had a nice time.
Which month were your raids carried out in?
In September.
1950.
September, or yeah, sure, September, I think. But it was what we'd been trained for, and they were very successful as well, you know, and certainly something to get the old adrenaline going. I suppose we were lucky we didn't have opposition from it.
What happened next after the raids?
We went back to Camp McGill and carried on training in that, you know, training for a while. And then in early November, I think we went on the USS Jackson, I think it was. We went across to Ham Hung and Ham Nung. I get them both mixed up. Ham Nung was where the where we actually stayed, I think. And it was quite cold then. To get up for a wash in the morning and that, you had to break the water on the, break the ice on the water bays and things like this. And we did quite a bit of training going out patrolling in that around there. And I can remember being there on, we were there for Thanksgiving Day on the 24th of November, because that's when a Marine took a liking to my Greenberry. When an American chappie took a liking. You could sell them for $200, but you were told, you know, be it on your head. And somebody took a liking to mine and lifted it. And this was when Peter Thomas had a spare one, and he gave it to me, and he said, if you lose this, I'll have your balls for a necktie. Because he'd used it for the Palestine campaign. And it was afterwards, when I was coming home, that I offered it back to him with the hole in, and he said, "You better keep it." But I suppose about the 25th or 26th, we moved up to Kota Rhee. And it took us all day. The bridges were all blown in front of us, you know, and we moved up. It took us all day to get up there. And we got up there in the evening. And they'd been under attack a little bit there, up and around there, you know, and there was enemy all about.
This is the American Marine Division?
No, this wasn't the American Marine. This was the post, the first stop at Kota Rhee, so far up. And we stayed there overnight. And they said, well, dig in. But we couldn't dig in. The ground was like concrete. It was just frozen solid. There was machine guns there. And you had to clear the snow away from them and everything. So we had little two-man bivvies we put up between three of us. And we did four on and two off all night. And when you crawled into the bivvy, it was so cold that you just had a cigarette. You couldn't sleep. It was too cold to sleep. And we did that all night. Then first thing in the morning, got up early, first thing in the morning, we put some of our compo, a tin of beans and that on there. They had a fire there, warmed them up a bit, had a bit of early breakfast, broke out a section of mortars, because I was a mortarman anyway. Well, and we started laying down with the mortar bombs and that. The Americans had a section of mortars out as well. In fact, I think there was about six or eight mortars altogether in the line. And our chaps started advancing. We were going to move up then towards the reservoir. And they didn't seem to have gone very far anyway. They were before they come under attack, you know, they're fighting their way forward. And we were laying mortar bombs down. Then we moved up. And I remember about lunchtime, we had something to eat and we were waiting for some tanks to come up and join us. A story. There were some American tanks that were going to come up and reinforce us, and then we were going to push on. And I remember melting some snow to have a drink in there. And we then piled on the trucks when these tanks come up, and we started to move forward. Then we got bogged down again. There was machine gun fire coming from this shack, about 50 to 100 yards to our right. And we pulled in round on the riverbed. And they called up an airstrike, which came eventually, and put a napalm bomb straight on top of the shack. And then we started moving off again. And by this time, I suppose it was about 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, it started getting dusk. And we were, my truck, we tossed up earlier to see which one we were going to go in, heavy weapons. It was Peter Thomas and Fred Hayhurst and some of the boys who took the machine guns and went in the other truck, which was a one-tonner, I believe. And we were in a three-tonner, the old American three-tonners, which had double wheels at the back, etc. And we had the high-explosive ammunition on board. We were topped right up with high-explosive mortar bombs. And we had the mortars as well. And there was about nine of us on the truck, I suppose. And we were bouncing through riverbeds and that, where bridges had been, you know. And, oh, God, you know, if this anything goes up, it seemed so dangerous at the time, you know, because the truck was loaded right at the top with ammunition. And as it got dark and we got further on, we were just into an ambush, and they just hit us. They did, the Chinese, you know, unbeknown to us, the Chinese had come into the war and that, and they shot the chap next to the driver, and Joe Cruz gave him a morphine injection. We put him on a stretcher. He was a Corporal Hill, and then they shot the driver. Every time they just kept shooting at the cab and that, you know, and all hell broke loose, actually. You know, you could see the Chinese.